Welcome to the first episode of The Edge, the podcast that looks at what's happening next in Canadian innovation. I'm your host, Kate Kenyon. Here at Mitax, we're at the crossroads of innovation in Canada. Every year, hundreds of companies and thousands of researchers come to us looking to combine their ideas to make innovation happen. This gives us quite a view. We get to see what the brightest minds are coming up with all over the country. We've got stories to tell, and we want you to hear them. Robotics, artificial intelligence, fashion, athletics, conservationism, whatever it is that makes you geek out, Mitax is on the cutting edge. This is a podcast about what's next, about what emerging Canadian innovators are doing to improve our world. This is The Edge. Episode 1, Growing Colour. The fashion industry. Designer labels, red carpets, and style magazines. Canadians love clothes. The average household spends $285 on them every month. And we export some of the world's most beloved brands, including Canada Goose and Lululemon. But under the glitz and glamour, a darker reality. Sweatshops, carbon emissions, landfills. It's a story we're all sadly familiar with by now. The fashion industry takes a terrible toll on the natural world. In recent years, sustainable or eco-fashion has become a growing force, particularly here in Canada. But despite these advances, there's a huge problem no one has managed to solve yet, and it's something you've probably never even heard about.
Most people don't realize, actually, is that textile dyeing is contributing to 20% of global water pollution.
This is Iris Redinger, founder of green tech company Material Futures.
The textile industry is actually the second largest industry after natural gas fracking that's contributing to this water pollution. So in Canada, we're very fortunate that, you know, we like to swim in our lakes and rivers, we like to visit waterfalls across the country, but in many other places around the world, including Southeast Asia, they're the ones that actually are seeing this now, that a lot of those industries have left Canada. And it's not like we can necessarily turn a blind eye as consumers or as a country to what's going on and the choices that we're making.
As Iris says, the fashion industry is behind one-fifth of global water pollution. It's all down to the dyes used to colour our clothing. They are synthetic, toxic to the environment, and they're sullying water systems across Bangladesh, China, India, and beyond. The sheer scale and pace of the fashion industry make this a huge global challenge, but Iris thinks she's found a solution. Creating her company, Material Futures, in 2018, she and her team have developed a new and surprising way to dye clothes without the environmental damage. I sat down with Iris at the Mitax Entrepreneur Awards in Montreal earlier this year, where she had just been given an Environmental Entrepreneur Award for her remarkable idea. Here's what she had to say.
Iris Redinger, hello.
Hello.
Welcome to The Edge.
Thanks so much.
The first episode, no less.
Wow.
We've pretty much dragged you off the stage. You were on the podium only, it seems, minutes ago. Can you explain to us what just happened?
Yeah, it feels incredible. I'm so grateful to Mitax for giving me the Environmental Entrepreneurship Award today. So Material Futures, the name, stems from the idea that at our company we're developing new technologies for the fashion industry primarily. And so our first technology going to market next year is a dye colorant technology. We're using microorganisms to produce colorants. There's no microorganisms in the actual colors themselves.
Okay.
or the final fabrics.
To be clear.
Yeah, no one has to worry about that. But they are the ones producing the colorants, and we have a proprietary process to extract out those colorants and use them in conventional dyeing methods, as well as more exciting and innovative dyeing methods that are a little bit more environmentally friendly.
From what I understand, we're talking about tiny microorganisms that can dye clothes. How exactly does this work?
Color is naturally produced in nature that we're familiar with, some of them more than others. We know that in the fall, leaves turn colors, and there's a natural process involved with chlorophyll and other different types of molecules, and we're used to that in our environment. But what we've done at Material Futures is evaluated a whole range of colors that are produced in nature and analyzed the genes involved with producing those colors and then genetically modified them in specific organisms that, you know, we're used to scaling up on a larger scale. And we're able to now replicate that process with a couple of different colors, and we're going to market with one specifically first. It's sort of a purple blue, so think of a royal purple.
Nice, sounds lovely.
Yeah, it's sort of, we're thinking it could work in applications like denim, but also for just general applications in life, like athleisure and general lifestyle. And so we're able to produce a full range of colors, harnessing the power of nature and using also the power of synthetic biology.
Are there some colors that are more tricky than others to produce? I know a sort of blue color is not common in the natural world. That's Are you coming up against that?
Bring up a good point. So like red, blue, and let's say black and white are the hardest colors to find in nature. And so that's exactly why we're targeting blue first, to kind of show that this actually does work and we can source a lot of these kind of more challenging colors from nature. We actually wore, I would say like t-shirts that were dyed with our pigments at different pitch competitions and sort of networking events. Unfortunately, I neglected to bring one with me to Montreal.
Oh, that's so cool. What's your favorite color that you tend to wear?
I wear the purple one a lot. Yeah.
Nice choice. Yeah.
There's a yellow one that also gets worn a lot.
What Iris is describing, the redesigning of organisms for useful purposes by engineering them to have new abilities, is called synthetic biology. It's a growing field that combines biology and engineering to design chemically synthesized DNA, thereby creating organisms with novel or enhanced characteristics and traits. It basically takes the plants and microbes all around us and tweaks how they function to make them do useful jobs. It takes millions of pigment-producing microorganisms to create a viable amount of dye. Growing colonies of these microorganism strains is done through a process of fermentation. The microorganisms are fed like yeast is fed sugar during brewing, and they process this food into useful byproducts, in this case, pigment. In this way, Material Futures is able to scale its technology and produce greater quantities of its product.
I've always been a firm believer of fermentation, mostly from a human health perspective. You know, once upon a time, we lived on all things fermented because refrigeration didn't exist. And in my mind, we're simply going back to where we were then, using fermentation as a means of producing value molecules.
This is Beth Mason, CEO of green tech incubator, the Verschuren Center, which works closely with Material Futures.
Most people have had beer or wine. That is produced by fermentation of yeasts. Now, those yeasts can consume sugar and they spit out ethanol. That's the foundation of your beverage. Those yeasts can be modified to produce something other than ethanol. And so if you simply imagine a very glamorized brewery, instead of producing beer, it's producing a whole array of other chemicals.
It took me a while to get my head around this idea. I didn't study synthetic biology in school, but then Iris didn't either.
You've spoken with great expertise about the scientific side of this, but you're actually our only award winner tonight with something of an artistic background and artistic interests. You have a degree in architecture, is that right?
Yeah, I would say even when I applied to architecture school, I sort of told my parents, like, I'm not planning on becoming a licensed architect. And they were shocked. I mean, they were like, why would you waste your time and money to do this? But for me, it was about building a foundational skill set and building, you know, a reputation within the university and understanding how things get done. And the fashion industry is something that, you know, I learned to sew when I was 7, and I worked on some couture fashion designs. It's definitely one of my sort of hobbies and interests. And I definitely learned and knew a lot about, you know, this problem relating to industrial water pollution that's coming from this industry. And I was thinking a lot about, you know, how might I be able to solve that?
And how did you come to understand the complex scientific stuff here? Is that through working with your team, or did you study that partly at university?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I definitely, you know, relied on the expertise of other students and other people on the team. So there was a biologist early on who kind of came, who was also studying at the University of Waterloo, and we worked together.
This is where MITAX came in. We gave Iris funding to develop Material Futures through our Accelerate Entrepreneur program, which also allowed her to tap into the MITAX network to find other team members with scientific expertise.
That was the beautiful thing about the MITAX internships that I was able to complete and got funded through MyTax. So we were able to hire undergraduate students as well from the University of Waterloo to bring the areas of expertise that I don't inherently have. Yeah. For those that don't know, the eAccelerate is, allows an entrepreneur to actually work on their own company as a student and work towards commercializing their research. So this was an amazing opportunity for me, especially my undergrad, to have that opportunity and be sponsored by MyTax and have that funding supported through them.
When MyTax senior advisor, Ashley Hannon, first received Iris's proposal, she had this to say about it.
The idea is to mentor these companies and these students that are working on these projects to help give them the tools they need to succeed and give them some time and financial resources to de-risk that for them and give them some time to really work on these challenges while minimizing a bit of that undue stress on them.
What is it about Iris's Material Futures idea that suited the Accelerate Entrepreneur Program and MyTax as a whole so well?
I think Iris's particular stage when initially connected was that she was looking to optimize, looking for expertise to take her idea to the next level where, she can begin commercializing it. So from the MyTax perspective, it allowed her connections into campus where she may not have had them before and understand the impact of making it a bit more efficient and effective. Where she was at with her time to validate her idea and actually solve that research question of, is this a viable solution? I think was a really good time for her to come in and look at this MyTax project because it will move the field forward in biology, in the fashion industry, and in lots of academic disciplines.
Moving the field forward is Material Futures' mission, but in a sense, they're doing it by looking backward.
Historically, we've always used vegetable dyes and from plants and, things in our surroundings. But with the advent of petroleum dyes really in like the 1860s, that's when petroleum dyes really kind of took over the entire market. And now 99% of all colorants are petroleum-based. And, it's great that we're able to return to nature again and look to biology, harness the power of biology in producing all of these different molecules and different products.
Iris is right. Humans used to use things found in nature to produce colours for our clothes. For thousands of years, plants, insects, and even sea life were used to provide paints and pigments. So, what changed? Why did we ever stop using the natural world for our dyes? Well, it was all down to an accident. The story begins in England in 1856. William Henry Perkin, teenage chemistry student, was enrolled at the Royal College of Chemistry, but he carried out the assignments his professor gave him in the rudimentary laboratory he had fashioned in his London apartment. William was supposed to be finding a way to make quinine, a treatment for malaria, but while mixing compounds together on his lab table and hoping for quinine to appear, he suddenly found himself looking at a brilliant purple substance. William hadn't made a treatment for malaria. He had accidentally created the colour mauve.
Wow!
The beautiful purple stain he had somehow created from aniline and alcohol was a rare and luxurious colour, and it had taken very little to make it. Sensing he might be onto something big and fearing a visit from his professor, William took his colourful extracurricular experiment down to the garden shed. It was here that he was able to adapt the substance into a dye, which he named mauvine, the French word for the purple-pink mallow flower. William couldn't have planned his discovery better. Victorian England was right in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and coal tar, which contained the aniline he used to make his dye, was all over the place, a byproduct of booming coal gas and coke manufacture. Not only was his purple dye cheap to produce, but it was also more vibrant than the naturally derived dyes of the time. Clothing manufacturers were delighted. Purple, long considered the colour of prestige, was very tricky to produce. It had to come from a particular species of snail, or, delightfully, from bird excrement. When Queen Victoria herself wore mauvine to her daughter's wedding in 1858, the colour's popularity was sealed. Other vibrant aniline colours were soon created, including red, blue, green, and black, and William's accidental invention became the world's first mass-produced chemical dye. Factories shot up all over Europe. Dyes had gone synthetic, and there was no turning back. Back to Canada in 2022, and William Perkins' legacy is everywhere you look. Your shirt, your dishcloths, the cushions on your couch, all of them were probably dyed using modern iterations of Perkins' synthetic dyes. The discovery of a cheap, easy way to dye textiles helped transform the fashion industry into the fast-paced, trillion-dollar mega-industry it is today. But what's been the real impact of this progress? William Perkin could never have foreseen it, but his cheap dyes have come at a high cost to the planet's water systems. I spoke with Leah Barrett, professor at the School of Fashion at George Brown College.
The issue that has been discussed extensively is, I think, consumption of water. People have been made aware that, you know, a single T-shirt uses many liters, jeans three times that. And that points in the direction of the importance of water in textile production. The dyes themselves, so 50% of them, the commercial colorants, use azos. There are some dangerous ones, not all of them, but there are some that have to be very carefully managed. Some of these break down to form what are called aromatic amines, and these can be released from fabric and become carcinogenic. But then even common adherents, so things like formaldehyde, heavy metals, PVCs and phthalates in printing, you know, salt that is also used to promote the exhaustion of dyes. And then, of course, for impact on water systems, there are some chemicals that have a high biological oxygen demand and chemical oxygen demand. So these, what happens is that they rob aquatic life. So plant and fish life, and this causes death of those ecosystems, right? So it's very problematic.
This is usually water that local people use to bathe, drink even? Is that right?
Absolutely. There will be local communities around these areas that have poor water conditions. Yeah, polluted water. Using them for in clothing, yes, washing, you know, dishes, kids bathing.
You can actually see this pollution in the water. In some communities, living alongside textile processing factories, water sources turn lurid shades of purple and red. This is a big, entrenched problem, and it's happening on a global scale. If someone is going to solve it, their solution will certainly need to be scalable. Will Material Futures be able to apply their solution widely enough to make a difference? Can a natural solution really compete in a synthetic age? Beth Mason is the person to speak to when it comes to green tech viability. This is exactly what the Vashuren Centre, of which she is CEO, is all about. This is also where Material Futures are developing their biotechnology to infiltrate the global fashion industry. I asked Beth about the potential synthetic biology has to transform the way we manufacture products and even replace petrochemicals.
Biomanufacturing is everything that you have in your scope to as a large corporate procurement chain that derives currently from petrochemicals you can make from microbes. And so biomanufacturing is the green way of making all of those chemicals, materials, even food additives, crop additives, all of those things. So touches so many sectors, whether that's a bio-based polymer, whether that's a green chemical, whether it's a bio-nylon. You know, from a consumer perspective, you can imagine if you look around your office or your home, so many things are produced from petrochemicals. All of those can now be produced by the same mechanism. And it almost feels like there's nothing that you couldn't make this way. It's an ever-growing demand, and it's an ever-growing field, and I think it's going to become a much bigger part of people's everyday lives.
In the case of someone like Material Futures, does it look like they will be able to fit this solution into existing infrastructure without too much disruption and additional cost?
So your question, if you think about Material Futures, if they have a bio-based dye, is it easy enough for, you know, a large company to adopt? And the answer is yes, any molecule can be replaced. So where a petrochemical produced dye drops in, this would simply replace it. The biomanufacturing sector will be a dropping piece to our economy in Canada. So the source material for biomanufacturing is all things carbon. And that basically is usually a derivative of our commodity base. So whether that is forestry biomass, whether that's pea starch, whether that is, you know, glycerol from ethanol production, whether it is methanol from Alberta, it touches every province's primary commodity sector, but is the upcycle value creation for it. And so to be ready to scale, and this is where, you know, the environment, which includes MyTac, is so good in that to scale, it needs everybody to help. It's not, you know, small little pieces of early top money. It's about all the partners in the ecosystem surrounding companies like Material Futures, bringing those resources together so that those companies can afford to scale.
Do you have any sense of how far away that stage is for Material Futures?
I would say probably most companies are 2 to 5 years away at this stage from their full-scale plant, depending on where they're at. Material Futures is a fit for the Vishrun Center capacity because they've been through accelerators, they've got their technology to the right technology readiness level. IRIS really came along more recently, and so they would be in the 3 to 5 year. But again, I would love them to be ready in a year. But, you know, science is not like that. You take a step forward, and then you maybe have to make a little tweak, and then you make another step forward. And each one of those scale-up steps, that's the beauty of having access to scale-up, tells you what you need to know to then leave the building with your full-scale plan.
There are big hopes for Material Futures and their idea. As Beth says, they are one of many small companies in Canada that are leading the eco-innovation charge. But what's it been like on the ground, building this startup company from scratch?
I'm a young female entrepreneur, and I started this company while I was in university. And I think the biggest kind of challenges and struggles that I had were finding mentors and then accessing the capital to actually make this happen. And so I have to say the capital portion hasn't been as much of a challenge as the mentorship portion. And I'm very, very fortunate that there were professors at the university who wanted to help a young researcher, and that I found people in industry who are willing to support me. But I would say in industry, you know, pitching to investors, meeting people, networking, I would say the fact that I'm a young female entrepreneur has had challenges. Industry response is mostly from a kind of technical assessment. Like, they're kind of looking at this, like, does this fit our consumer needs and our needs as a brand? And they've been very responsive to it. But I would say, yeah, mostly from an investment perspective, I think they're still feeling that, you know, where is your male co-founder and this kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
The thing is, if investors are waiting to see a male co-founder, they might be waiting for some time.
I would say there's probably more female founders now than there are male, and particularly in synthetic biology. So if you go back 20 years, most classes were largely female. So we've got a good long pipeline of female scientists that are now coming through as entrepreneurs. I think this generation is entrepreneurial. That's the beauty of it. You know, obviously the ones we meet are a select group that have come through graduated accelerators, but they're not pie in the sky entrepreneurs. These guys know what they want to do. I'm always amazed at what comes next. I love the variety, and I love to see young people so enthusiastic about where they want to make a difference. And it also is very satisfying that, you know, whereby for some people it might seem like, oh my gosh, the world's in a mess, where how are we ever going to get through this? I get the pleasure of seeing how we will make that change and how we will adapt to it, because we're already doing it. So that's the piece I love, is seeing young people grow in the direction we need them to help us solve the world's problems.
And here at MyTax, we couldn't agree more. You've been listening to The Edge, a podcast by MyTax, dedicated to telling the stories of Canadian innovators that are transforming the world. The Edge is produced by Catherine O'Brien and Kate Kenyon. Be sure to visit us on social media and at mytax.ca to learn more about how we can help you turn your big ideas into reality. And if you liked this episode of The Edge, be sure to leave us a review and subscribe for more stories about how Canada is changing the world innovation by innovation. I'm your host, Kate Kenyon. See you next time on The Edge.